Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, the speaker is Jeanette Rodriguez. She will be speaking on Marian devotion and spirituality. So let's listen in on Jeanette Rodriguez.
The topic says Marian spirituality, but actually I'm going to focus in on one Marian image. One that most of you probably would not be familiar with, and that is Our Lady of Guadalupe. How many of you have even heard of that? Our Lady of Guadalupe? Okay, good. Anyway, that's the one I'm going to focus in on, and it might sound a little radical to some of you who, A, don't have a Marian devotion in your tradition, but two, because for some people, this particular image is more than, and for some, not even Mary, but the maternal face of God. So you decide for yourselves. I'm just going to tell you the story. And show you some slides of the research that was done on this image, and you can make your own decision. Hi. Let me begin by first telling you how I even came to this image. I'm a New York Ecuadorian. You probably can hear my accent. Bicoastal. My family's from South America, and I was born and raised in New York. When I became a young adult and moved to California, I encountered for the first time Mexicans and Mexican-Americans. Now, I hadn't grown up with Mexican and Mexican-Americans. I grew up with Puerto Ricans and Cubans and Central Americans and a lot of Latin Americans. And I was a missionary for the Roman Catholic Church. I'm a Roman Catholic theologian. And when I started working with the campesinos and the Mexicans and the Mexican-Americans, I noticed that they had this affective bond with this image, Our Lady Guadalupe. Could somebody put the slide projector on for me? Just turn it on. Turn it on.
Do you need the screen?
Yes. Thanks. I forgot. Yeah. Just turn where it says power. Just turn it all the way to the right. Okay. And that's not the image of Our Lady Guadalupe, but we'll start with this. That's right, that's Quetzalcoatl, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Anyway, so this image, Our Lady of Guadalupe, and I was sort of like a community organizer. I was very involved in justice and peace issues. And when I saw the people attached to this image, like any good missionary or should be missionary, you sort of find out why the people love this image so much. But because of my own agenda, I confess, I said, well, gee, if I could tap into that energy, if I could understand this image, maybe I could help the people move towards liberation, because as a liberation theologian, that's what I was really interested. I really didn't have a clue about this image, and being Roman Catholic, I get this image of Mary as being very passive. Any of you have that same feeling? You get this image of Mary who's this fair-skinned, blue-eyed, dressed-in-blue woman who sits with her hands like this. And I don't know about you, but our priest would say, be like La Virgen, be like the Virgin, quiet and gentle and quiet and passive and quiet and service. And growing up in the 60s, you kind of grow up going, who wants to be like that? So there was some resistance to it. And what I started to do was to sort of listen to the people's stories. And I became very fascinated with the stories. And then I went to Mexico to do some original research on the image. And while I was there were some scientists there doing some scientific studies on the image. So I was able to get in on that, and that was really a revelatory experience for me. I was so moved by the story and by its implications that I came back and changed my dissertation, if you can imagine that. Being a PhD program, 2 years in the program, all of a sudden saying, I don't want to do this, I want to do this, And so it cost me 2 years of my academic life, number one. It cost me a lot more things, but that's the one I'll share with you. It cost 2 years of my academic life. People didn't think studying Guadalupe was theology. It was soft theology. It was not academic, systematic theology. So I went and took my exams on Lonergan and Rahner and all the big names, so no one would ever question my PhD. But my real love was for this particular image and the implications, which I believe are very liberative and very radical. So I began to do my dissertation on it, and there was a great deal of resistance to this study. They didn't want to hear about the maternal face of God. They didn't want to hear about the contributions of indigenous cultures to the understanding of God. I went to Berkeley. Cover my mic. I went to Berkeley. So you can imagine how difficult it was to get this project through. And it was a very painful process, actually. But I'm here to tell you there is justice in the world, because now the dissertation has been published into a book by University of Texas Press Austin, and it's number 2 on their list. So there was a reason. There's a reason. So I'd like to begin by first reading to you a letter that the bishops of Canada wrote to the Native American peoples of Canada. And the American bishops did something similar. And this is what they said. They said, "Long before my people journeyed to this land," and they're speaking to the Native Americans, "your people were here, and you received from your elders an understanding of creation and of the mystery that surrounds us all that was deep and rich and to be treasured. And we did not hear you. When you shared your vision, we could not hear you. In our zeal to tell you about the good news of Jesus Christ, we were closed to the value of your spirituality. We confused Western ways and culture with the depth and the breadth and the length and the height of the gospel. We imposed our civilization on you as a condition to accepting the gospel. We tried to make you be like us. And in doing so, we helped to destroy the vision that made you what you were. And as a result, we are poor. And we are poorer in our understanding of the image of the Creator. It is an image now in us that is twisted and blurred, and we ask you to forgive us. We ask you to walk with us in the spirit of the Christ so that our people may be blessed and God's creation healed." Now, this was written in 1986.
That's wonderful.
It is very wonderful. I mean, when I first got a hold of this, I mean, I just wept. And then actually the elders gave it to me. When I was, I live in the Pacific Northwest right now, and I'm working with some shamans. And when I said to them, "Is reconciliation possible after everything that the church has done to you?" They're a real blessing to us in even their capacity to forgive. And then it's the elders that showed me this document. No, this was not the Roman Catholic bishops. Although the Roman Catholic bishops did write a document. This particular document was not written by the Roman Catholic bishop. It was written by the United Church of Canada. Yes.
So the name you mentioned, is that an Indian tribe?
No. A shaman? Oh, a shaman is just a healer. A healer in the native cultures, in the indigenous cultures. So what I'd like you to do, because this story is a story that must grab you in your heart as well as your mind. In other words, if you try to understand Guadalupe just with your mind, forget it. You just won't get it. You must go to that place inside you, and I talked about this yesterday, this place, it's a very hard place to get to, but it's a place that when you get there, you discover things about yourself that nobody can affirm for you, and nobody can take it away from you. It's yours. That's where God is. But to get there, you got to go through the uglies. You got to go through the ego. You got to go through the things that keep you back. You got to go through, you know, little, like when I talk to children, I tell it's like Pac-Man's, you know, they sort of, you got to get through that. And to help you then, I've put together some slides and music just to help you get to what I call that other level. I ask you to dive. Just keep diving with me. Just see where it goes. So could someone turn the lights off, please?
And shut the blinds upstairs. Thank you. Because it came through the open.
Now, do you remember when the angel Gabriel in the Hebrew scriptures, in the Christian scriptures, tells us that Gabriel went to Mary and asked her if she'd be the mother of Jesus? And what was her response? Anybody remember?
Be it done unto you.
That's right. Be it done unto me. Be it done unto me. That was the Hebraic way of saying yes. Okay? But I want you to take a look at these images and listen to the phrases and the songs and just sort of record for yourself what speaks to you. What, you know, this is part of the discernment process. Okay, what is it that gets triggered for you?
I hope this works, because yesterday when my slides got stuck.
What happened?
And do you have like a scissors or a nail file you can slip through? Good. Ready? Let's try it again.
How do you feel about having this light off? You put that on.
You can turn it off if it bothers you. I'm not sure where the light is.
The way to unplug it to do it is yank your plug out behind you. There you go.
Okay, there you go. Thanks. You have to turn the power on all the way to the right in order to turn the light on.
Okay.
Ready? Try it again. Why don't you see if the tray is in right?
We have two slides stuck together.
Actually, yes, that was beautiful. Yeah. Would you turn the light on, please?
There is one in there. I'll have to get out. So.
Okay, go ahead.
This, nice. These must be anti-Guadalupean forces.
Well, you know, you laugh, but actually, I really believe that kind of stuff. I believe that there are times when, you know, I don't want to say that. Let me think. Am I being taped?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I definitely don't want to say that.
Then it'll be a less good.
Bad energy, yeah, sometimes bad energy. Well, no, let me put it this way. There are some cultures that believe that when there is a healer around, or when there is an opportunity to grow, you know, to reach towards, you know, spirit, whichever way you want to go, it's not up or down, but that there are sometimes forces that will try to block you, you know. And the more of a healer you are, you know, the more potential you have, the more obstacles in your way. Because they want to discourage you, you know. Does that sound kind of crazy?
No, I believe that.
No, it sounds faithful.
I really like this place. Really be careful the way you speak.
In our conversation yesterday, we were talking about a lot of the issues you're going to be dealing with in your talk. One thing I wanted to ask you, since we got a little bit of time,
sure, go ahead.
Maybe you can address this later. But throughout the Southwest, and especially Phoenix where we live, there's a place in the Mexican community where there's been apparitions of the furniture,
mm-hmm.
almost on a, like on a weekly basis,
right.
At a certain time of day, and these churches are being flocked to by
mm-hmm.
thousands
mm-hmm.
of faithful.
Mm-hmm.
In this one instance, there's a one woman who
I think I've heard that.
And,
mm-hmm.
and sees the receives the Virgin, and she speaks to her, and then she goes out and tells the congregation. Have you researched this? And
no, I haven't. I haven't done any recent research of apparitions, except a little bit of the one that's happened in Mozhegoria. You know, and that's isn't that Poland?
Poland.
But you know, I'll tell you something. You know, the tradition of the church is always very suspect of apparitions in a healthy sort of way. I mean, I think, you know, you can't believe everyone that they see, you know, the Mother of God or God or whatever. And you know, one criteria is always, you know, by their fruits you shall know them, right? So that if this apparition, if this belief, if this is doing something for the people in such a way that they're bearing fruit, they're healing, they're reconciling with one another, they're loving one another, then, you know, I don't think people get too upset about that. What I am very suspect of, though, is the kind of messages that frighten people, you know. Like, if you look at some of the other apparitions, they're always like, now, I'm holding up the son of my, you know, I'm holding up the hand of my son, Jesus, and you must convert and you must pray, otherwise I'm going to let the hand go. Like, whatever. You know, it's very threatening. It's very frightening. I don't think that's of God. Because I think that if the essence of God is that God is love, then God can do no else but love. You know? So I don't believe that any of the tragedies that happen to us, you know, or any of the catastrophes that happen to us come from the God that we believe in, you know. And yet God is always present, you know, in that tragedy.
Well, have you heard of more instances of this? Because there's two of them.
Well, in the last 20 years, actually, there have been a number of reports.
Yeah.
So there have been. Were you having problems with that still?
Yeah, I think I've got it now. I've got all the things that are stuck out.
Okay.
Anyway, could you try to advance it?
Yeah. Sure. I'm a little concerned because the light bulb's not on, so you got to turn it all the way on.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you have that.
It's a light bulb.
Oh, goodness.
Okay. Let me see if I can. Let's see if I can.
Yeah.
For a second.
and I'm really sorry because setting the mood is a big part, a big part of the whole process. Do you have another slide projector?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Let me, we can come back to that. In the meantime, how many of you are familiar with the story about Lady Guadalupe? Okay. Three. Okay. Let's do that. Let's do the story. I'm going to do a New York version of the story, though. Now, you have to remember, this happened 400 years ago, right, in 1531, right, 10 years after the conquest. Now, as I mentioned before, in order to understand this particular story, this particular image, you have to understand the historical context of what was going on. What happened in 1521? Anyone? 1521? Big year.
Cortez arrived and brought illness to Mexico City and conquered it.
Well, it was the discovery, you know, in quotes, of the Americas, right? You had 16th century Spaniards who came to the New World, again, once again in quotes, you know, and they came for God and for money, right, for riches, and they discovered this land. And, you know, what we call it in Spanish is a choque de culturas, a clash of cultures. So you have these 16th century Spaniards and these indigenous peoples, you know, great people, great civilizations, been here before the first Spanish ship landed, you know, discovered the zero, had astronomy, had a very complex religious system, social stratification. So these two cultures, they come and they clash. Neither one had a clue about the other. They looked different towards each other. They couldn't communicate to each other. Now, no conquest is good conquest, but this particular conquest was a brutal conquest. Because unfortunately, we've inherited a mentality that difference is never just different. Different always has to be better or worse. And so when the Spaniards arrived and they saw these people, they basically thought they were closer to the animals than to humanity. I mean, one of the big theological questions in the 16th century was whether the Indians had souls or not. I mean, that was these letters that were passed by you know, pastors to their bishops and stuff. Somebody had a question?
1521 is simply the year that Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses on the door of the castle. There are the two worlds.
There we go. So there was two clashes, two major clashes on two different continents. Except this one wiped out a whole civilization. Okay, this one, you know, raped the women and children and destroyed the temples. And this one basically wiped out 80% of the population. You know, this one had some major ratifications. Some of the poetry that comes out of that time, the Aztec poetry, reads like this. See if it reminds you of anything. It says, "Our cries of grief rise up and our tears run down. The Aztecs are fleeing across the lake. They're running away. How can we save our homes, my people? The Aztecs are deserting the city. The city's in flames. All is in darkness and destruction. These are the acts of the giver of life. Nothing but flowers and songs of sorrow are left in Mexico, where once we were great warriors and great wise men and wise women. We know that it's true that we must perish, for we are mortal. You, the giver of life, you have ordained it. Have you grown weary of your servants? Are you angry with your servants, O giver of life?"
Psalms.
That's right, the Psalms, the Lamentations. "I cry out to you, Lord, and you do not hear me. O Lord, how long must I pray when I cry out to you and you do not respond? Hear me, O God, have you abandoned me?" You know, the Bible's full of these lamentations. These lamentations, these cries, are not just in Aztec poetry or in the Psalms. We hear them today. Where are these cries rising out of? Where are these cries? Where are these cries now, today? Where do you hear them? That's right, they come out of El Salvador, they come out of South Africa, they come out of the Bronx, they come out of the barrios, they come out of Winnet. I mean, people are still crying, you know, crying out to a God to respond. Now, the greatest tragedy, I think, that happened, besides the, you know, the disease that the Spaniards brought and the destruction of the temple and the destruction of their social system and the rape of the women, the worst thing, I think, that they did was to destroy them spiritually, in the sense that basically the Spaniards told the Indians that they didn't have a God. and the indigenous people are going, what do you mean we don't have everything we do? Everything we do because of our belief in our God. And now you're telling us that we don't have a God? And so basically their attitude was, well, if that's true, I mean, if we don't have a God, and you guys won and we didn't, so maybe that's true, well then, you know what, then we just want to die. I mean, then let us die. You must get in touch with that feeling in order to understand the rest of the story. So I'm going to try to help you once again with a meditation. What I'd like you to do is just close your eyes and to try to remember a time in your life when you really felt like nothing. Something happened in your life, whether it was someone hurt you, or some tragedy, or something was taken away from you perhaps, and you were left with a very, very deep wound or emptiness. But you must dive down and remember. Remember yesterday, for those of you who were here, I said, remember, you are more than what you are. Today I say to you, remember the pain. Remember the aloneness. Once again, to help you, just remember what you must get in touch with that feeling. Second. Okay. How many of you were able to get in touch with that feeling? Remember. How many of you were able to remember what that felt like? Okay. And I want you to take that feeling, okay, that individual, very private feeling, and I want you to allow it to grow, and now everybody in this room feels that way. Okay? Your feeling, how you felt, everyone in this room feels that way. And then we're going to let it grow, and everyone in Holden Village now feels that way. Right? And you keep expanding it. So you come to a place where you understand that a whole civilization felt that way. Can you imagine? A whole people, a great people, a whole people felt that way, continue to feel that way. There are people in this world continue to feel that way. Mm-hmm. That's the mood. Mm-hmm. That's the context, if you will, that you need to understand in order to appreciate the apparition of Guadalupe. And, yes, lights, please, thank you. So, while I'm stalling for time, because the slides aren't here yet, so I can go through them.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
Just to elaborate on what you're saying a little bit, is that I think a lot of times people don't understand that what you're talking specifically about, the Mexican people, have never gotten over the conquest. It's been 500 years. Mm-hmm. We have not gotten over the conquest. Native Americans have not gotten over the conquest. Blacks have not gotten over slavery. Just because 500 years have passed. Mm-hmm. That 500 years in the context of our existence on this continent is very small.
That's right. And why I try to help you understand that experientially is because what Zarco was saying is that it is engraved in the psyche of those of us who are what we call ourselves as mestizos. We are a blend, a product, if you will, of Spanish and Indian blood. All right? And it's almost engraved in our soul, this experience. Passed on from generation to generation. Yes, Peter.
The song that came to mind for me was Psalm 137, which is that really angry song,
yeah.
Just smashing the heads of those who have done this to us against the rock, the babies against the rock.
Right.
And that poem is written during the exile, the time
that's
when
right.
The Israelites have been taken from Israel and transported to Babylon.
That's right.
And their land is devastated, and the idea that their God has been defeated
that's right.
is very clear in their mind.
That's right.
Where his heaven was. And then along with the Holocaust, the exile and the Holocaust are the two major identity-forming pieces of personality for many, many Jews. And you know, Zarco's saying that many of us haven't gotten over capture, domination.
Conquest.
The Jews haven't gotten over that in 20, but that was 586 BC,
mm-hmm.
So in 2,500 years, they haven't gotten past that. And there's really no way to, or it's not desirable to get past it. Because it makes us who we are.
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of resentment right now in the Native American and Hispanic communities. So much emphasis, so much talk has been about the Holocaust, with Schindler's List and all of that. And it's just almost like, you know, we keep hearing about the Holocaust. But what about the Holocaust in the Americas?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, we don't hear about that.
Right.
You know, it's
there.
It's
so good for me to be here, because when you say what happened in 1521, my experience is that's what Martin Luther King had been up. And in all of my experience studying American history.
Oh yes, you won't find us in American history.
Well, you know, the first people to come to America, that was Columbus in 1492. And after that, the next important thing is 1620 and Plymouth Rock. And this thing, you know, what happened in Mexico or Peru, incidentally, what the Spanish did, with no. And so I'm going so fast.
Well, remember that history is usually written by the guys that win.
Well,
and I mean
win,
guys. Guys that win. So
wow.
In the last 20 years, with the influx of people of color and women into the disciplines, whether it's theology or history or psychology, you know, sort of resurrect, you're sticking your hand back in there into history and pulling out things that have been left behind. Okay, Carmen, and
one of the reasons
and then
I guess I'm here is because I have a Native American Mexican Aztec or some kind of conglomeration, whatever it is I'm supposed to be saying that, you know, the ancestry is, daughter-in-law, who has a spirituality that is so absorbing.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that the Holocaust in Native America is not ended. It's happening right now
That's right.
in the Amazon, in Brazil, where I'm from. jungles being burned down and people are being displaced. Mm-hmm. And the same thing that happened in America 1492 and 1500, 1600, where diseases were brought, it's very much a reality. Mm-hmm. And the Holocaust of our people in terms of the spirituality is happening every day.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, yes.
I wondered if, this is very new to me and I find it very interesting. The movie The Mission,
yes.
That, they didn't make a big thing of it, but it was a tremendous movie. Okay, did that happen?
Yeah. Let me put it this way. The same response that when people said that about Schindler's List, they said, did that really happen? And people and the Jews who were in the Holocaust said it was worse. Same thing with The Mission. It was worse.
Everyone should see that movie, and it didn't get much billboard.
I visited places in Brazil where that movie was filmed, that Mission. Yeah.
Well, I'm really sure it was true, but it was like, was it true to the period of time that we're talking about? Mm-hmm. That was part of the...
I wanted to spare you the gory details, but if you want to, I can tell you. But I'd like to just move on a little bit more. I want to at least tell you the story. Yes.
I wanted to clear up something about bringing up the Holocaust and the exile. It's not to say that it's worse or different.
Right.
But to say that this kind of angst is part of our scriptural tradition. It's part of being Christian, and it's a part that we often just set aside because we don't want to deal with the lament.
Right.
We don't make room for it in our spirituality, mm-hmm. In the Western Christian tradition, quite often.
How are we doing?
Get there.
Okay. Let me quickly run by the story with you. And again, this is a story written in a totally different culture, and it's a culture, it's called Nahuatl, which is a subculture of the Aztecs. It's easier to remember the Aztecs. It is written very poetically. It's written in a style, a literary style called disfrasismos, which what that means is it's not opposites, more like complement. The God that is far and near, God of the sky and the earth. For us, it sounds almost complementary, but that's not what it is in this literary style. But I don't want to get into much detail about that, just because I don't have enough time. But let's get to the story. So 1521, you have the conquest. You have 10 years, of conquest. And the story starts in 1531. Okay? So the story begins 10 years after the conquest in 1531. And it happens very early in the morning, And that's very significant for this particular indigenous culture, because in the morning, when the darkness becomes dawn, and that break from night to day, it's very symbolic, the language. And let's see, this hill right here is called Tepeyac, T-E-P-Y-A-C, Tepeyac. And over there, what's your name?
Kathy.
Where Kathy is, that's where a 52-year-old man lives. His name is Juan Diego. So Juan Diego lives over there. Tepeyac is over here. And over there by the corner is the central location of power and ecclesial reality. That's where the bishop lives. That's where the governor lives. I don't know if any of you have traveled, but in a lot of the other countries, the governor's palace is always next to the bishop's palace, on the hill. So it's over there. Anyway, so this man, 52-year-old man named Juan Diego, who had been Christianized, he was on his way to what we would call today catechism class. Right? And it's about 4 miles from his village to this hill, Tepeyac, and another 8 miles to the to where the bishop is. Right? Mm-hmm. And this particular hill, Tepeyac, is 10 miles north of Mexico City. Right? That's Mexico City up there. And Juan Diego is walking, on his way to catechism class, and he hears, and this is very significant in this culture, which is why I use a lot of music in my talks. He hears music, and he follows the music up to this hill, and, are the slides working yet? Yes?
I can try it, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Excuse me. I'm going to just get the image that he sees on his walk. It's not true. You don't have it in. Anybody know how to work a slide projector? Maybe you can help Matt a little bit. Thanks.
I don't think you see that right.
Okay. So he's on his way, and he hears this beautiful music, and he sees this woman, which you will see as soon as we get the slide projector fixed. He sees this woman, and she's beautiful, you know, and the earth below her is glowing, and the birds are singing, and he kind of looks up to her, and she says to him, "Juanito, Juan Dieguito." Now, that is like saying John. If John is the name, saying Johnny, it's a diminutive, right? Juanito, Juan Dieguito, where are you going? Smallest of my children. Okay, it's a phrase. Smallest of my children. And he says to her, as if he recognizes her, he says back to her, "My dear child, I have to go to your house in Mexico to hear about the divine things which we are given and taught." And she says, "Know and understand, you, the dearest of my children, that I am the ever-holy Virgin Mary, mother of the true God, for whom one lives." And this phrase is very important, "for whom one lives." And she basically uses the names of the Nahuatl gods, but if you translate those phrases, they say things like the God that is near and far, the God of the earth and the sky. I mean, these little phrases that, taken by themselves, equal the name of a Nahuatl god. Now remember, she's not speaking in English and she's not speaking in Spanish. She's speaking in Nahuatl, you know, his language. She's speaking in his language. It's very significant. All right, so she says, "Know and understand, you, the dearest of my children, I am your most holy mother, mother of the true God, for whom one lives. And I have a living desire," she says. "I have a desire that you built me," and in the translation they say is a temple, but that's not the original in the Nahuatl. It says casa, a house, a home, right? "Build me a home here." In the Nahuatl. Now, this for me is such a significant message. She says, "I want you to build me a house here where I can show forth all my love, my compassion, my help, and my defense." Four things: love, compassion, help, and defense. And she says, you know, to whom is she addressing herself? She says, "To you and to all of you, to all of you who live upon this land." Now remember, 1531, there were no borders, right? So we're talking about the Americas. "To you, to all of you, to all who live upon this land." Here are the conditions. "To all of you who love me, all of you who call upon me, who trust me, I will hear your pains and your lamentations, and I will respond." That's the Guadalupe message. And I want to repeat it. "I am here to show forth my love, my compassion, my help, and my defense. To you, to all of you, to all of you of this land. For those of you who call upon me, who trust me, and who love me, I will hear your lamentations and your sufferings, and I will respond." La promesa, that's the promise. And then she says, "What I want you to do is I want you to go to the palace of the bishop." You know, I love these translations. It's not the bishop's house or the rectory. I want you to go to the palace of the bishop. I must be reading into these things. Am I reading into these things? The palace of the bishop. And after a long wait, because, you know, he's just an Indian, right? So the Spaniards are like, you know, he's an Indian, just wait, over there, wait. You know, they don't pay attention to him. And, you know, he waits and he waits and he waits. Now, the bishop is a nice guy. I mean, so he's a Spaniard. Okay. I mean, but, you know, there were some that really tried, you know, they tried to, you know, they sort of gave up on Spain and kind of wanted to plant the seed of the gospel in its original intent in this new land. So there were a few of those. And he goes and he tells the bishop the story, and of course the bishop, you know, gave him a break, you know. Juan, you know, I can't just believe everybody who comes in here and tells me that they saw this beautiful woman. You know, go back, think about it a little bit, come back and tell me again, all right? So, you know, Juan Diego comes back and he's discouraged, you know, and he's really feeling bad, and he comes to this point and he sees the woman again, and he says to her, "My dear child," it's very interesting, this is not a very good translation, "My dear child," it's almost like you're just as depressed as I am, is basically what he's saying to her, insane, "My dear child, I went where you sent me to fulfill your mandate, and it was with great difficulty that I entered the room of the bishop. I gave him your message just as you had told me to do. He received me kindly, he heard what I had to say, but he did not believe me." Now, this is another important piece of the document. He says, "My dear lady, I understood perfectly well in the way in which he responded that he perhaps thought it was an invention of mine. I beg you, entrust your mission to someone more important than I. Send someone more respected, more esteemed, so that they might believe him. You know that I am a nobody, a nothing, a coward, a pile of old sticks, just like these bunch of leaves. I am nothing. You have sent me to walk in places where I do not belong. Forgive me, and please do not be angry, my lady and my mistress." Now, when I read that, I read a number of things. Number one, what I call the psychology of the oppressed, okay? People who are constantly being, like, put down, knocked down, you know, just kind of, like, who am I? I'm nothing, you know, send somebody else. But the other thing is, he's really picked up on something that's true. Just think, if you wanted to send somebody to somebody important, you know, like your bishop or the president, or let's say your bishop, I don't know about your tradition, but if I wanted to send somebody to my bishop, not my local bishop, of course, but a bishop, you know, I would send someone who is male, right? Mm-hmm. Not female, white, a white male. You think it would help if he had a PhD?
Yes.
Sure, so white male PhD. Anything else?
Caller.
Oh yeah, white male PhD, cleric, right?
A little money helps.
Well, a little, okay, but so.
And he should be tall.
That's right, so, you know, and a tall, good, tall. So you already have in your head an idea of what sort of someone respectable and esteemed, right? You already have in your head who you would send if you wanted to send someone to someone of power, right, and prestige. But God doesn't work that way. You know, God always picks the people that the world rejects, right? And this is why Guadalupe becomes so important, because it's so easy to accept a Mediterranean Jewish man as the Christ. But when we look at a morenita, a dark-skinned, pregnant female, we have problems thinking that she might be the maternal face of God. But that's the challenge. If we can get my slides working. Okay. What?
The problem is they were put in the carpet, but I can do it by...
Okay.
Okay.
I'm not sure what you're saying. I can't control it then?
Yeah, you could tell me when to move the thing.
Okay. Go to slide number 15.
Okay.
And see where we're at with that. Well, anyway, so he comes back. He's very discouraged. And so the lady says to him, "Listen, my son." Ouch. Is that slide number 15? Good, because I didn't think so. So she says to him, "Listen, the smallest of my children. I have many servants," she says. "I have many messengers to whom I can entrust this message. But in every aspect, it is precisely my desire that you be the one to take this message. You are part of this plan." Okay, that's not it. So let's go to number 20.
Okay.
Oh, that's me in the Philippines. Nope, 25. Okay, go back, backwards, one. Go backwards, one. Here we go. This is what he saw on that hill of Tepeyac. Okay, this person is the Guadalupana, Our Lady Guadalupe. So what happened is, so he gets all excited and he feels all encouraged again, and he says, "Okay, I'm ready. I will gladly go and fulfill your mandate." Right. And the next day, what happens is he goes to the bishop and he tells the story to the bishop once again. Right. The bishop listens to him. This time, the bishop says, "Juanito, listen, I need a sign. You know, if I'm going to believe you, this is a big deal here, okay? You're telling me that the Mother of God, you know, appeared to you, she was a temple. I need a sign." All right, so Juan Diego's not stupid, you know, so he says to the bishop, "Okay, what kind of a sign would you want?" Right? But the bishop's not stupid either, and he says, "Well, she'll know," okay? So kind of leaves it up to the lady, you know. He doesn't ask for a sign. He says, "She'll know." All right. So Juan Diego trucks back here, meets Our Lady, tells her what happens. She says, "Okay, don't worry about it. Go back home, come back tomorrow morning, I'll give you a sign." Meanwhile, when he goes back home, he lives with his uncle named Juan Bernardino. And Juan Bernardino is sick with what was called at the time the fever. Okay, anybody know what that meant, the fever? smallpox, right, which wiped out about 60% of the population, right? Because the indigenous population didn't have an immune system against the the germs that the Spaniards, 16th century Spaniards, brought. So anyway, what happens is that now he's in a dilemma here because his uncle has just asked him to go get a priest, all right, because he's dying. All right, so Juan Diego has a major decision to make here, right? Do you go and get a priest for your dying uncle, or you keep your appointment with the Mother of God? So, not much of a choice, huh? What do you think? What do you think? Well, what would you do? What do you think he does?
Go to the priest.
Why would he pick the priest over the Mother of God?
Because it was
if she cures
father.
Him, that would be assigned to the bishop.
No, he's not that logic.
He cares about the uncle.
The what?
He cares about the uncle.
That's right. The uncle has a very, politically and socially, a very big role in the village. And so what happens is that, because he has to pass this hill, you see, so he comes this way, and if you can imagine him, you know, as I'm reading the documents in its original form, it's really kind of funny. He's almost going like this. You know, like, so he doesn't want to be seen, you know? And he gets, like, on this other side, and all of a sudden he hears, Juanito, Juan Dieguito, smallest of my children, where are you going? He's like, ah, and he turns around, you know, because now he's got to explain himself. And he says, what does he say? Lost my place. He says, my dear lady, I hope you are happy. He says, I hope you are happy. Because, well, wait a minute, I'm going to cause you some affliction. You mean that? I'm going to cause you... You see, he felt that when he told her that his uncle was sick, she'd feel bad. The social interpersonal relationships were such among the indigenous people that if someone was sick, of course you would feel afflicted. You would feel in pain. Isn't that what we mean when in theology we talk about the body of Christ, right? That if your hand hurts, it's not separate from the rest of your body, you know, that your leg would hurt, the rest of you would hurt somehow. And that's lived out in relationships, in interpersonal relationships. So she says to him, you know, my son, I don't want you to worry. Am I not here who am your mother? Are you not under the cool and the shadow of my mantle? In my presence, is there anything else for you to need? It's a really beautiful question. Is it, you know, standing before the presence of the Mother of God, is there anything else for you to need? Right? And so, yes, he cures her, and she tells him to go up to this hill and to pick these roses. Now, how many of you have ever been to Mexico, to where the basilica is? This hill, particular hill, is like a rock. Nothing grows on that except mezquites, cactus, tumbleweed-type not even flowers. Nothing grows up there. He climbs up this hill, he sees these beautiful Castile roses, and he cuts them and he puts them in his tilma, which is a covering, sort of like a blanket with a hole in it, and it's used for covering. And so he lifts it up, and puts the flowers in it, holds it like this, and she says, now hold it, don't show it to anybody, take it to the bishop, right? So he walks back to the palace of the bishop. Now, if any of you have ever been to Latin American countries, you know that you go through this wall, and then there's like a courtyard, okay? Usually a fountain, like this, and people are hanging out. And then beyond the courtyard is the house of the bishop, right? So there are people hanging in there. He walks into the house of the bishop, and he tries to get through to the bishop. Of course, everybody wants to know what he's got. You know, he's kind of holding it really tight. He finally gets to the bishop. Bishop says, is that the sign? And Juan Diego just says, yes. And before Juan Diego gives the bishop the flowers, he gives him this whole lecture, which I don't have time to read to you now, but it's actually very funny, where he accuses him of not believing, you know. And so
he gives the lecture, Juan Diego.
Juan Diego says, before I give you these flowers, I just need to say a few things to you. And he tells him all the things that he's seen and how the bishop didn't believe, you know. And so the bishop stands there basically and listen. Then Juan Diego puts the tilma down, and as he puts the tilma down, the roses fall, and this image appears on the tilma. Lots of people believe that the miracle are the roses, not the roses. Roses in December, they make a big deal about that. Maybe. But this image appears at that moment, the flowers are dropped. That's when the bishop falls to his knees. See, from my perspective, the real miracle is the conversion of the bishop. See, the real miracle will be the conversion of the powerful, will be the conversion of the rich. Okay, I don't mean people who have material goods. The rich who must be converted, you know, and take a stand with God's preferential option for the poor. So anyway, so that's basically a story. And that's a very, like, short story because we ran out of time. Did we run out of time? Oh, okay. Anyway, scientific study. Let me run by this quickly. Next. Now, oh, I'm sorry. Hold on for a second. One thing I want to point out to you is that when they saw this image is what's called a kodes. It's a image full of symbols, Nahuatl symbols. And I'm going to go through them with you right now. First of all, this black belt here, it's called a cinta. Could you focus it a little bit? The indigenous populations, at that time, when a woman was pregnant, she wore a cinta. That's sometimes in Spanish we say, estoy en cinta, I'm pregnant. So for many people, this kind of blows them away because this is the only Marian image that's pregnant, you see. If we look at her through our own Western European eyes, we're going to miss a lot of things. So we have to sort of put on Nahuatl glasses, right? When I get money, I'm going to buy glasses and give them out to people, you know, called Nahuatl glasses. For example, if we look at her hands, what are her hands doing? Right, for us, they're praying. Okay, but that's not the gesture for prayer in the Nahuatl culture. This is the gesture of offering in that culture. Okay? She has stars on her mantle. Remember that the Aztecs and the Nahuatl and all those people were very great astronomers. They did everything by consulting the stars. These are the rays of the sun. Okay, remember, the sun god was the most important god to them, who came from the east, the region of light. The eagle is a very important symbol in that culture. Okay, do you know how Mexico was, the land of Mexico was sort of located? Anyone?
The symbol of the jaguar consuming a serpent first on.
It was the eagle. It was the eagle, right. The gods told the Aztecs who were nomads at the time, you know, when you see an eagle sitting on a cactus with a serpent in its mouth, that's where you build your city. Well, where that place was where a whole bunch of water. Well, Mexico City is built on water. Okay. So anyway, this thing here is not horns, like some people say, this black thing here. It's the moon god, or the moon goddess. And all of these flower images mean something. We don't have time to go through all of them. And the most important symbol for me is in here, right in here on her womb, there's a little four-petal flower that's called the Nanniali. And what it means is the birth of the sun god. So let's put it together like a puzzle. The other thing I forgot to tell you is that on Tepeyac, this was the site of their ancient mother goddess called Tonantzin. So with all those little pieces that I give you, pull it together like a puzzle and tell me what you think the message they got when they saw this image. 10 years after the conquest, everything's destroyed. Here comes this image with their symbols. What does it say?
The message to who?
To the indigenous people? What was the message?
That Tonantzin, the beloved goddess, had returned to them.
And that she was pregnant with the new birth, or whatever that would be.
The birth of the sun god. Now, see, sort of like hieroglyphics, sun, it says sun god, but it's not clear whether it's sun, S-U-N, or sun, S-O-N. So in many ways, this image is a powerful image in terms of a prism, because, you know, my personal opinion is that they've Christianized this image too much, but that's okay. If the Christians want to claim her, and this is Jesus coming to the Americas, okay. But if you want to look at it from a non-Christian perspective, okay, the mother goddess, or the god who has a maternal face, if that's easier to handle, because the Aztecs believed that God was both father and mother. So one of the things they had a really hard time with Christianity was this God the Father. They couldn't get it. They were like, well, where's the mother? You know, it was not clear for them, all right? And today we know, those of us who do therapy, are clinicians, that for many people, it's very hard to identify with God the Father because of many abuse issues. And so I have found this particular image helpful for people who really want an image of God but can only relate to the maternal face of God. So I don't want to proselytize or position myself any one place for you. I want to say there are options. You can come and look at her in a variety of different ways. All I'm telling you is that through the Nahuatl theology, what we learn is that this is the maternal face of God who brings forth or manifests the birth of the sun god, however you want to interpret that. Okay? Now, as I told you, when I was doing my research in Mexico at the time, I was lucky enough to be there when there were these, and they were Protestant scientists, doing research on this image. Jody Bryant and Jody Smith.
What kind of research?
Well, let's go through and I'll show you. Next. We'll have to go through quickly. One of the things that they found interesting is when they look at the face, they couldn't figure out the material that made the paint to paint the face if it was a painting. See, they were still struggling whether this was a painting or not. Those who believe say this was not made by human hands. You know, others were trying to say, well, what is the material that was used? Well, they concluded that the face was just not made by human hands. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that if you notice in this image, one eye is light, one eye is dark. Okay, there will be a reason for that. And we'll just point out these things and we'll pull them together towards the end. Next.
Is this on fabric?
It's on, well, I have a picture of the fabric. It's more like burlap. The tilma that he was wearing was made out of very coarse, kind of holy, rough material. That's why they couldn't understand how you could have gotten such a smooth surface like this face on that kind of material. Nor could they identify the material that was used to make the color. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I'm not an artist or anything, so a lot of this stuff, is difficult for me to understand. This is a painting. This is not the image. This is a painting of the image that's in the what's called the Old Basilica, which is now a museum in Mexico City. Next. Oh, I should tell you that after Juan Diego showed the image, the bishop took the image and put it in his private chapel before he built a little hermitage, and then now we have a big basilica. Next, I'll show you what it looks like. Hopefully. Okay, a painting of the five apparitions. Next. We'll have to move quickly to get through this. This is a little, it's called a placita in Mexico City, and it's where Juan Diego stayed with the bishop and the image, taking care of the image. Next. This is 10 miles north of Mexico City. Next. This is the basilica, the new one, as it stands today in 10 miles north of Mexico City. And structurally, it's shaped in indigenous architecture. Okay. Have you been to the basilica, Sarko?
Not that one.
Okay, the new one.
The old one.
Yeah, the old one I love. The new one I don't like for one reason, and that's because there's so many thousands and thousands and thousands of pilgrims that come there. I'm almost embarrassed to tell you that they put a conveyor belt in front of the image. So like you stand, I mean, the clash of efficiency. So you stand on this conveyor belt and you go, then you get off and you get another one. Oh, and it's just really heart-wrenching to see that. But again, the clash of cultures between like standing there and being efficient. Right? Next. Next, these are just pictures of people that are there. You know, the churches in Latin America are rarely empty. I mean, people come there, and especially to the basilica, because she is their mother, and they believe that she will respond to their sufferings and their pains. And they come not in an arrogant sort of way. They come, you know, on their knees, either for favors or in thanksgiving for something. Men, women, and children come. Next. I always say to people, I take a group every 2 years with me, and the people are always more amazed and more moved by the faith of the people than they are of anything else that they see. Stop.